She says she started out pounding on Quaker Oats boxes in the third grade. Her name is Amy Knowles, and she's considered firmly established as a foremost percussionist in contemporary music in America today. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations, and on this edition of Conversations, percussionist Amy Knowles. My first curiosity is about kind of the life of a percussionist. Amy, it seems to me that many professional musicians focus. He is a violinist who plays a classical repertoire. She is a jazz pianist. But a percussionist has so many instruments, so many possibilities in her realm. Is that part of what makes you such a versatile performer? Because you do play in so many areas.
Well, you have to be versatile, I think, to just survive as a musician these days. And I think the wonderful thing about percussion is that there are so many different areas you can go into. I can play with a pop band, or mm-hmm. I can do different ethnic musics, new music, classical music. There's a lot of different choices for me. And I think that keeps it interesting, too. It doesn't get real old. Mm-hmm. You know, if I were just playing in an orchestra, playing timpani or something, I think after a while I would get a little bored with that.
Be too narrow a field. Yeah. You said, how many instruments do you play? Do you have any idea?
No.
See, I wondered about that.
Quite a few. Mm-hmm. Quite a few.
When I think about percussion, I mean everything from the triangle to the bass drum to Eastern instruments.
And there's found objects, uh-huh. which are percussion instruments. So
like,
wherever I go, I can. Well, I have a Legs egg from the pantyhose company.
Right.
And if I put BBs in there, I can shake it, and it becomes this wonderful swirling water sound that I can make continue and continue. So it's things like that, but percussionists that work in the contemporary music field, which is my main focus, are known for playing on things like brake drums mm-hmm. from automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
And John Cage wrote for those way, way back. You know, certain composers back in the 40s and 50s started just doing with what they had on hand, making instruments out of things.
That's part what makes it fun.
Yeah. And with electronics now, it's wonderful because I have a sampler. So if I can get a sound out of anything, I can sample that and have that sound with me when I go on the road or something. So I don't have to carry brake drums and, you know, a million other things.
You have them in memory then.
Yeah. On disc.
I wanted to ask you about this. First of all, is the diversity of the instrumentation what took you naturally into computers, into electronic music?
Well, I went to a rehearsal with composer Morton Subotnick, who's one of the first electronic music composers. And I'd been working with him and playing on standard percussion instruments. And we were starting a new piece called Hungers, and I walked into the rehearsal, and there was this 4-octave long rectangular metal box with all these rubber pads on it. He said, "Well, you're playing this." okay. And it was called the Cat MIDI Mallet Instrument, K-A-T, named after Bill Katowski, who designed it. And
MIDI means?
MIDI means musical instrument to digital interface. It's a way of translating pitch numbers into things that synthesizers, you know, can read. It's numbers, zeros and ones. It's what computers are based on. So computers and synthesizers and effects units all understand what's coming out the chord to them. In the same way.
Okay.
It's a standard, it's a musical standard that's been set up in the last 12 years, I think. But what was so amazing is if I hit a marimba, I get a marimba sound. And when I hit this MIDI mallet instrument, I could get any sound that was available on a synthesizer or a sampler. And that was the beginning of it. Then I realized that I can design the sounds in the synthesizers and create samples and do just absolutely anything I want. So it just opened up a whole world for me that I didn't have before.
When you think about where computers are taking music, is that what you think about? Doors opening, windows opening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is Amy Knowles. I said one of the foremost contemporary musicians. She performs as a solo artist. She performs with the California Ear Unit, which she helped to found 9 years ago?
It was more like 12.
Further, 12 years back. A 7-member group that ranges through instruments. We'll take a look at the Ear Unit in a couple of minutes. She has, she performs regularly with the LA Philharmonic New Music Group, Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, and is a founding member, of course, of California Ear. A lot of recordings with, as backup for other musicians, also with the California Ear Unit, has recorded for Ear with New Albion. Recordings for Nonesuch, CBS, RCA, Relativity, New Albion, and Crystal Records, among others. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. There will be people who are listening or watching today who won't have the foggiest idea of what computer-assisted music or electronic music is like. When they think of percussions, they think of drums. Can you take the concept of computer-assisted music and verbalize it for us so people get what happens in a performance?
Sure. It's hard to say one specific thing. There are many different things that you can do with computers and music. One of the simplest and more basic things is to hit the return button on a keypad and the music will come flowing out like a sequence, more like a tape. And that's more desirable than a tape because it's talking directly to the synthesizers, and there's no it's not second generation because it's on tape or whatnot. But basically, in that instance, the musician is playing along with the computer. But what I've been mostly interested in is the interactive possibilities with. I was first introduced to this with Morton Zabotnick, who has a program out called Interactor that can follow a conductor's tempo. He has designed a MIDI baton, so it will feel the ictus, and the sequence that's being played by the computer will go with the tempo of the conductor. And they have this really wonderful thing called a window of believability, which is if the conductor drops the stick and the ictus takes way too long, it won't believe it. You can set up windows for that. So that's one way. But what I've been working with now is a company called Opcode put out a program called Max, M-A-X, which is an interactive programming environment. And there's literally thousands of things you could do with it. It's just very open. So you have to do a little programming. But one of the pieces, I commissioned a piece by Todd Winkler, and it's for a MIDI drum set, the drum cat that I use, where I'm playing on pads. You've seen a lot of these types of things in pop bands. And I hit one pad, and that sends the computer into record mode. So when I hit that pad, anything I play is recorded by the computer. And then I hit another pad, and it'll play it back. And I can play along with it at the same time. Now, that sounds more like just a sequence, fancy way of triggering a sequence. But if I hit the pad softly, the sequence will be played soft. If I hit it And I, you know, hard, it'll be loud. But there's other features of this particular program that Todd designed that make it follow tempo. And other pieces in the past, Peter Otto wrote a piece for me that set up different regions on the MIDI mallet instrument, say from C to C, and then C to F would be these different regions. And different things would happen when I'd play in those regions. If I'd hit softly, the computer would reiterate the note. And if I'd hit it loud, it'd go boing, boing, ding, 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 ding. And certain pitches up here would send whoom, these sounds just flying. And it was all very reliant on how hard and soft, fast I played. So it listens to what I do, which is a real give and take.
This involves composing as you're playing, doesn't it?
Well, it depends on the piece. In most of these instances, it's my parts are all written out. And they have heard in their heads or, you know, at home, what will happen as a result of my recording this passage and then playing it back against this other passage. So what they develop is a kind of counterpoint in the Todd Winkler piece is counterpoint. And that piece was called Follow Play at first. Mm-hmm. Turned into Stomping the Ground because it's just this great drum set solo on top of being an interactive piece of music. You know, so.
Has this transformed your life as a solo performer?
It made my life as a solo performer. I didn't have much of a desire to really be a solo percussionist because I felt there are a few good pieces for solo percussion, but it's very, very difficult to write for more than, say, a marimba solo. That's fine. But I really enjoy playing multiple setups of percussion. So mallet, a marimba here above and a vibraphone below, and a rack of tom-toms and gongs and cymbals. You know, I do that a lot with the ear unit,
right.
You know, with the contemporary music. But there's a problem that a mallet doesn't sound so good on a drum that might be really nice on a marimba, and vice versa. And so you start holding all these sets of mallets and triangle beaters out here, and, you know, and there's dead time if you have to put the sticks down. There's just nothing happening. So with computers, there can be, you can fill in that the dead air with things, and then it just became, you know, all these possibilities, you know, these things that you can do with it. And I got a grant from the Brody Arts Foundation in 1985, I think, to commission a composer and buy some gear, which basically started my indebtedness because it got me involved, and now it's this there's a phenomenon called techno lust.
I must have
that
another.
Once you get something and you realize, oh, this is wonderful, but then you start to see limitations, and so do the manufacturers, and they start coming up with something else that really is what you wanted it to be able to do. And so you just keep, you know. But it's also, it's very exciting, and it's, you know, and the companies have been great as well, you know, helping artists out and things like that with deals. And
you once said that being a musician today was almost like taking a vow of poverty. Is that scene improving any through grants?
Actually, recently it's getting better. It just seems that I'm a firm believer of if you want to do something, you can do it. And I think it's always been nice that I like Thai food, you know, as opposed to, you know, filet mignon or whatnot, because I've never felt too, you know, impoverished. But, you know, there's always, there's not a lot of money in new music. I mean, that's just not what it's all about. You know, I'm not in it for that. And, you know, if I want to play in a rock band and tour, you know, that's, you know, a possibility. But I do that every once in a while for fun, actually. But, you know, it's definitely not a sort of get-rich kind of thing. But it's just so, so important. You know, this is the first century that we're really not listening to the music of our time. And it's, to me, that's just unbelievable. You know, Mozart had benefactors, and people would go and listen to his music. You know, and in the last century, more people go to symphony concerts than new music concerts. You know, if we're talking about music in the classical genre, which contemporary chamber music is, my solo work is, my work with the duo Basso Bongo with Robert Black, the Ear Unit, that's in the classical realm. I'm working on busting out of as many of those little cliche boundaries as I can and taking music, you know, trying to commission or beg composers to write pieces, you know, that I think are interesting composers, and, you know, to take music to where it can go. You know, I want to see what can happen.
We've given me a lot to ask you about. Why aren't we listening to the music of our time? What's going on with the culture or the music?
I don't know. I grew up with a television, and I think a lot of people did. And I don't think that we're taught to really go out and seek new things. It's sort of a comfortable society now. Mm. We can sit at home and, you know, get anything we need. And I fall into that trap sometimes too. You know, you're tired and life goes on and everyone's moving and doing their things. But I really don't know. I think a lot of music, a lot of contemporary music has pushed some buttons. And I've spoken to musicians, you know, in casual, you know, in the shopping line, and say, oh yeah, I play contemporary music. Oh, I hate that stuff. You know, that's ugly, you know. And
so hard to listen to.
Well, there were pieces like that, and there still are, but there are also pieces that are, you know, with the whole minimalist movement that Terry Riley and Steve Reich started, that became much more listenable. And that also got to a point where I think it got a little too easily digestible. And certain composers have stayed there, and others of those have grown and let their music change. It's like minimalist art. There was this sort of Rothko-esque sort of things going on where it looks like a sheet of black, but if you look at it, you can see the very differences in texture. And you have to really listen and develop an ear for these things too. That's another thing with contemporary music. You have to go and listen with an open ear. And it's also a big responsibility of the performers to help an audience understand what they're hearing too. And I think there was a lot of that sort of classical tradition of walking out on stage, playing, and walking off, which I do sometimes too. I mean, we don't always, the Ear Unit doesn't talk much at a LA County Museum concert. But if we go into, we have an audience there, and the audience has been there, and they're familiar. But if we go to smaller communities, you know, we talk about it. And we also do a lot of children's programs, where we talk about rhythm, melody, and harmony, and then throw in a little, you know, new music wherever we can.
And this is what it sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah, and sure. This is, look at this. This is a piece of artwork, but we play this piece of artwork. It's a drawing. But composers were making drawings and, you know, thinking of it as music. And that sort of brought out that whole improvisational, you know, contemporary music style.
Let's listen to a piece of music. Can we do that?
Sure.
Good. This will put Amy to work.
Okay.
Percussionist Amy Knowles will bring us a piece by composer John Bergamo. in the next few minutes. Okay. The piece is called Piro Bowl. The word bowl is an Indian word that means what? Tell me again.
It means a composition of music.
Composition. So a piece. Mm-hmm. And Piro is where John Bergamo is from, a community in California. And these are?
Tablas. North Indian drums.
Music first, and then an explanation. Here. For the magic of modern science. Thank you. by John Bergamo. This is Amy Knowles on Conversations today. She was educated at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, working with Pavel Burda, and also at the California Institute of Arts, mostly under the conductor of Stephen Moscow, or at least happily under
And with John Bergamo, actually, as well.
Amy Knowles, our guest today on Conversations. Tell me a little bit about the tabla. The construction I see is a metal bowl.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Skins, but this is rubber here?
No, that's a combination of what I'm told is cream of wheat paste and pig iron powder.
You said that earlier.
Yeah.
I thought you were joking.
No. That's what it is.
What we're talking about for people who can hear
it's
but
wheat
not
paste,
see, it's a center circle right in the center of the tabla. Wheat paste.
Yeah.
And it does what?
Well, it doesn't do quite as much on this drum. It has a lot to do with the character of the sound in general. But you don't hit that. You just sort of go around it. But on that's the baya, the low drum, and this is actually the tabla. But they call them a set of tablas.
This is the smaller drum Amy now has in her hand.
But this drum, the spot is very important. This finger rests there to create a harmonic. If you stop a string halfway between, it doubles the pitch. If you just lightly touch it, you will hear the harmonic, the higher, the overtones. So that instead of so low.
I see.
So you get that, and it's used for that sort of thing.
Difference between playing in the center and playing on the edge.
Yeah.
And you tune it with the leather straps that come down from it.
It comes with a little hammer, generally, with Ganesh, the god of drumming, on the end. It's an elephant god. It's quite wonderful. And hammer the pegs down, and to get the tension going, and then fine-tune along the braid by hammering.
And is there a well-tuned tabla, or do you tune according to where you want the sound to be?
I think you find there's generally a range of each drum that works. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a drum head on a normal tom-tom. There's some pitch that really resonates on any shell. So there's a bit of a range. If I had my own tablas from home, generally with this piece, I can't remember if it's a C sharp or D, but I tune it to that because it works really well with the computer track that I created for the piece.
Right.
You know.
And what you were playing is all computer?
That's a computer sequence. Pyru Bowl can be done by one to as many players as you want. And there's little solo sections, as you heard, or the trade-off. Helps to have two for the trade-off. But I thought I'd really like to do it with computer. And John said, go ahead. So I just found a lot of sounds that I liked and put the piece of music into the computer, which was kind of difficult because in Indian music there's things like tihais and chakradars that are rhythmic cycles. It's say you have a phrase. Pyru Bowl is based on this head. Ta din takita ta din ta din takita ta din takita ta din ta din takita ta din takita ta din ta din takita ta jonu jonu ta jonu jonu ta jonu jonu ta. That's the rhythmic. If you're talking jazz terms, that's like the rhythmic head.
Focus center.
Yeah, the theme.
All right.
And certain things happen in there where you'll play a very small rhythmic phrase over three times, and the first time it starts on the beat, the second time it starts on the and, and then it comes back around on one. So putting that into a computer that likes to be in 4/4 was a mental challenge. I don't want to have to go through again. I ended up writing everything out in eighth notes and just watching how they'd fall over 4/4, knowing how the piece really works. But that's translating it from an Indian aesthetic to a Western aesthetic.
This is conversations we're talking today with percussionist Amy Knowles. Clearly, it can be done.
Oh yeah. See, that's the brilliance of the compositional techniques in Indian music is they all work out. They come out on one, but they're just mind-boggling when they're going by. Quite often, a tabla player and sitar player will have someone keeping time, which is partly so they know exactly where they are, but I think it's also a bit so that the audience can see how wild it is.
How far they're ranging from the
center. And where it's going from what sounds like downbeats to what really is, you know, and just the elaborateness of the phrases.
Do we Westerners need this kind of an education to fully understand contemporary music? I mean, it's not going to be quite the same as you describe in understanding where Indian music is going when it starts to express itself. But do we need to educate ourselves to understand what's being played in our music world now?
I think it helps. I mean, I don't know every possible type of, you know, I wish I knew more about African percussion. I studied Balinese gamelan and tablas when I was at CalArts. And I'm very glad I did. I think that the world is getting so much smaller because of media and you know, just the availability. You can call anywhere, you know. Mm-hmm. So there are all these influences. And I think it's really wonderful to be able to draw, like what John did. John was a very well-known contemporary percussionist. And he got that bug to start playing Indian music and just really got totally into that and started writing music that uses all these techniques, and it's marvelous. I mean, he wrote a piece for 5 amplified cymbals for the ear unit, and my part used tabla notation, so I could play on cymbals and create all these colors that you just couldn't get, and it's very hard to explain. So when he sends that piece to people that don't have a tabla player, he writes the rhythms. But it's another tool we can use. Yeah.
When you say that the kind of chamber ensemble work that California Ear Unit does is classical music, and then you followed by saying, "And I'm trying to break out of the classical mold." What does that mean to you? I'm playing classical music when I'm playing in the California Ear Unit.
Well, that's just kind of where the CDs get put in the record store bins. You know, the music comes from a classical tradition of having been composed music. It's composed music, and a lot of the composers that write that music have learned all about counterpoint and romanticism and all those things, and they have those tools.
They can trace themselves back to Mozart.
But a lot of the music that I do, that Basso Bongo does, that the Ear Unit does, is of young composers who aren't ashamed of their rock roots or jazz roots or whatever, you know. And the music that results is really got a lot of energy and punch, and it's not classical music by any means. It's so impossible to describe new music because I don't know how many different composers there are writing new music, but 80, there are people who write like other people, but I'd say 80% are writing their own types of music. Some use serial techniques, others use throwing I Ching coins, others just write music. one of the drum quartets that John Luther Adams has written that I'm out here
Fairbanks composer,
working with,
John
Fairbanks
Luther
composer, uses one of the theories of chaos.
Chaos theory.
Chaos theories. And a lot of computer music composers are working with fractals now. And computer-generated fractals, which is a
mathematics term.
Yeah, yeah.
And meaning?
I understand fractals to be part of the chaos theory, the sort of new physics. I can't come close to explaining it. But it's a mathematical way of explaining things that happen in nature that aren't so explainable, like gravity falling.
Yes.
It's where things start going, and then this little chaotic thing happens, and all of this happens from that. And
what you're saying,
as far as I can go with that one.
And what you're saying is that new music is being informed by all the possibilities of our time, from rock and roll to chaos theory.
Yeah. Well, if you look back, I mean, Bach is very mathematical if you try and figure it out. You know, so there is a big connection with mathematics and music. But I think the more brilliant composers have used, like Elliot Carter, for instance, writes some very 12-tone-y music, but he breaks his rules all the time based on emotions. And that's what music is about. I think it's wonderful to get ideas and draw from wherever, but if you kind of don't really like exactly what's happening, you change it, you know, and that's, you know, music is an emotional thing, and it should always be that way.
And that's true for the composer. It's also going to be true for the interpreter, the percussionist, right, as you perform that piece.
There's definitely room for interpretation. I mean, you have to stick to the notes and what's there. I mean, there are, for us, it's generally no improvisation involved, but there's quite a lot that you can bring into it, you know, just emphasizing certain notes can change a phrase completely and change its sort of tonal balance and make it something more yours, you know. Not to steal their music from them, but, you know, to put some of your personality into it. That's what I'm trying to say.
This is Amy Knowles on Conversation. I'm your host, Susan McGinnis. What about being a woman in the contemporary music scene? You started falling in love with percussion. I assume it was an evolving process when you were in third grade. Mm-hmm. I don't quite know how long ago that was, but you have to be in some ways breaking some ground as a woman percussionist and as a woman in contemporary music.
Well, in grade school, it was a little interesting because I played drums in the little high school or grade school orchestra, and
I assume that was cute then.
My parents might have thought it was cute. Most of the other students, isn't that a boy's instrument? You know, but I had an older brother, and I wanted to do everything he did. And when he stopped playing trombone and went to tuba, I played trombone too. Only I didn't realize that I needed glasses. So, the music had to be too far away to play the trombone. So I gave up trombone and just stuck with the percussion. You can keep it a lot closer. But it was also I've since the beginning was banging on things and just, you know, I have too much energy. I have to get it out somewhere, I guess. There was a little bit of that, and I think I never got to be in the jazz band in high school because I think that the band director really didn't, he never came out and said it, but it felt like, you know, a girl shouldn't be the drummer in jazz band, and I would go to the music clinics at Stevens Point and get in the first jazz band. You know, I come back, why can't I be in the, you know, but that sort of thing. So there was a little struggle I could be the timpanist, but I couldn't be the section leader, you know, certain things. There was a little bit of that, but I think it helped because it made me push. It made me, you know, I want to do this and you can't tell me I can't do it kind of thing that gives you a little strength. And then I'm kind of belligerent in that way. I love, someone tells me I can't do something, I'm really going to do it. But it also helped then when I was older and trying to get grants, there were a lot of grants for women. And for me, that was a fortunate situation, you know, and I'm not going to say that that's not true, you know. But I haven't gotten a lot of grants. I got that one that really helped get everything started. And I think, you know, I mean, I certainly believe in what I'm doing and think that it's very, I think I'm good at it and it's important. But I, at that point in time, it didn't hurt to be a woman.
So you advantages know, so. And disadvantages. But the disadvantages were all right because you were kind of gutsy.
I kind of got a little strength from that. Yeah. Yeah.
You have endorsements now, and largely from computer companies. This is not like getting an endorsement from Reebok. So what does it mean when a software company says, please, Amy Knowles, use my stuff?
Well, basically, how it works is they'll send me new software of things that they're developing. And one is Max, M-A-X, the interactive software, and say, here, see what you can do with it. You know, have some fun, do something, you know, take this program somewhere that we might not have thought of, or, you know. And that's great for me because the programs are expensive. And, you know, there's lots of little things you like to try. And this way, I really wanted Max because I knew these other composers that were working with it, and I wanted them to write me pieces and want to be able to perform them. And you have to own the program to perform them legally. You know,
of course.
The whole software, yeah. I mean, these, you know, you don't, that's how they make their living, you know. And it takes so much work to write a program. I can't understand how they, it's mind-boggling. So I feel committed to that too, so it's very, it's a great situation. And they come up with new upgrades and they send them to me and I can, you know, work with that.
In some ways, are you kind of the research and development arm in the music sphere of their software?
I think they'd like me to be, and I'm trying to be. One of the difficult things is that working with programs is so time consuming, and while I've been up here, it's been wonderful because during the day I'll go and sit with my computer and work and try and learn more about the program and come up with ideas and things that I want it to be able to do and try to create these little modules that will make it do it. So it's a matter of time, and when you're a performing musician, I also manage the ear unit myself, and Robert Black and I both manage Basso Bongo, so we have to keep putting information out and calling people and trying to get work and practice and learn programs. And so it's a caffeine kind of world.
You and Robert are bi-coastal, aren't you?
Yep.
How's that for creating music together and gigs and practice and all the rest?
Well, it's interesting. We've written one piece together called Big and Cheap. And we did that over the phone. We conceived of it, I think, actually, here in Fairbanks, the last time we were working on a John Adams project, and sort of talked about concepts. And I went home and played around with a rhythm program on my computer and samplers and came up with some sounds. And we sent tapes back and forth. He sent me melodies on bass. He plays this wonderful upright electric bass we call the basso anorexo because it has no body. Just these And so we would trade back and forth, and we get together before a tour about a week, week and a half, as much time as we can afford, and just work, get it together.
Push.
Yeah. Yeah. This one's going to be interesting. We have a program in 3 weeks at LA County Museum, and one of the composers called last night, well, I'm starting the piece and it'll be done in a week. And another one's been faxed. It's still being faxed up to us. And another piece will arrive. David Lang is redoing Born to be Wild for us. And that should be here tomorrow. So we're just going to be working night and day. And, you know, that's okay.
Percussionist Amy Knowles here on Conversations. A bit more of an introduction. Amy works in California's correctional institutes, taking electronic music to people who are incarcerated, both men and women. Well, I'll ask her about that in just a second. Also, again, with California Ear, and has come to Alaska twice. This is the latest time for both performances of and recordings of John Luther Adams' Earth and the Great Weather. The last trip was to perform on Coyote Builds North America here in Fairbanks 2 years ago.
Actually, I was here three times. The Ear Unit came to Fairbanks with the to do some new music workshops with the symphony and a performance. That was fun.
They have been spending their time when not playing and not rehearsing skiing under the aurora here in Fairbanks. Amy Knowles, our guest on Conversations. Tell me about taking electronic music into prisons. What has that done for you as well as for people in prisons? What are you taking in when you take in electronic music?
Well, I go to different places, and most of the prisons I've been in, I go and do a performance and talk about it. Talk about the pieces and, you know, what's going on. And in that situation, it all depends on the place. You know, once it was out on a flatbed truck in the sun at 90 degrees and the pads were bubbling, and it was outdoors, so the audience sort of kind of dispersed. Some hung out. First, there wasn't macho enough, so a lot of people just bailed out on the whole thing. And that was an interesting situation, but a few stuck around, and it was fun. It was sort of a little worthwhile. Basso Bongo went to Norco prison, and between every single piece, how do you do that? What is, you know, what's going on there? It was just this incredible energy. And then I go to Chino a lot. I've done a 12-week residency there, and that is a different situation where we created audio tapes for radio. And I bring in a rack full of gear, synthesizers and reverb and effects units and all sorts of things. And one of the best moments of probably my musical career was when they had this cheesy little Casio MIDI sax. It's got one MIDI channel. It's very real basic, no velocity, you know, nothing, just it's basic little plastic saxophone. And and one of the inmates played sax. He goes, okay, well, I'll play some, you know, some sax. And I plugged the MIDI cable into my sampler that had a string orchestra on it. Whoa, and he hears the string orchestra.
Huge sound.
How did you do that? And then it was just brilliant. I mean, from then on, I just played through all these sounds, and he was doing the most amazing stuff with these sounds, and I, you know, that I would never have thought of. Musically, you know, that it was just, so I just sat there and let him go, you know, and just, you know, basically took notes, you know. So we sort of, one piece was an inmate's story about how and why he got arrested. And it's sort of this kind of little chase scene thing, you know, basically, of what was going on. And I won't go into the details, but we just did sort of an audio track behind that of acoustic percussion sounds and sampled things and things off of CD sound effects. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'd all just say, well, what would go good here? Or just improvise with a bunch of stuff. And it's pretty cool. It's pretty amazing what came out of that.
Right.
Yeah. Huh.
Where do you want to be in 20 years?
What do I want to be or where?
Where? I don't mean geographically.
I'd like to come back to Fairbanks and ski under some more auroras. I think I just want to keep doing exactly what I'm doing. And, you know, I just really am happy. So just
playing that stuff.
Do new things, yeah. Just keep things changing. Hmm.
We'll keep looking for it. Amy Knowles, thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Percussion on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Pleasure to sit with Amy Knowles, percussionist,
my pleasure.
During this time. And I hope you'll join me again next week.